My name is Roy Malloy, and this is a podcast called The Dawn of Crime. It's dedicated to the biographies of people who interacted with, came in contact with, and ran afoul of the law in a time period between about 1900 and 1920. This podcast is called The Suitcase Gang of Geelong, and it paints a picture of a group of young people who became a gang, and they were one of the more interesting gangs that I've ever researched. But this story has a context because it kind of falls into a time and period where there's a culture that we don't have in the modern era. So prior to this story, which is set with a backdrop of Geelong, which is in Victoria's western coast, and it still is a major city in Victoria, this story is a 1920s story. So it's not really the same as push gangs, but if you've never come across the term push gangs before, a push gang is a group of people who stand around on a corner and somebody walks past them and they physically push them. And it seems incomprehensible now, but this was a thing. This happened broadly in almost every state that I'm aware of. Victoria, but Melbourne and Sydney particularly had a lot of problems with push gangs early on. And they'd, you know, you'd be walking past the actual picture of somebody walking down the street. They see a group of typically young men with the occasional female person interspersed. They see this group of young men. They walk just on the pavement, head down, and then one of them pushes you. You turn to face him. Another one pushes you, and it doesn't matter what you do. You get pushed so much and so hard that you end up falling over. You hit the floor, and then the kicking begins. Your pockets are cleaned, and they run off. Therefore the name push gang. The female members of push gangs were called soakers because they were usually drunk, which is it's a sexist slur. It exists, but that's kind of the backdrop of this story, the context of it has a forebear of this kind of context. But this story is set in the late 1920s, 1928, in Geelong, which is a seaside town. I've always had I have a love affair with Geelong. It's got everything beautiful in one spot. But it was rougher back then. It was an industrial town. And it was kind of a hub where a lot of trading happened. And anything that was grown or reared cattle-wise or crop-wise along that western coast would come to Geelong, or down from Ballarat to Geelong before it went to Melbourne. Years later, the Ford factory would plant itself in Geelong and make it an economically viable city. But Geelong has a history of being a working city. I guess it's kind of not dissimilar in some ways to Birmingham in England, except it's got seaside beside it. But it's got that kind of feel in some ways. And so this story happens in 1928. It begins with a policeman with a fascinating name. I'm going to say his name, Sickerdyke. That's how I'm going to say it, because I think that's how it's pronounced. But it's spelled Sickerdick. Unfortunate name, but I'm going to say Sickerdyke. Now, Detective Sickerdyke is one of those cops who, from everything I understand, and I did a fair amount of research on him outside of this one individual circumstance, he's the kind of cop that seems to be methodical. When I say methodical, method, right? Like he does everything by the letter, he's process bound, and he's a very good cop. But he also seems to have there's a whole bunch of stories about him in newspapers in this time period where he trusts his gut instinct. And this is one of those moments. So Sickerdyke is he's a detective, and therefore he's got a bit of free license to kind of come and go as he needs to in the spectrum of what he's policing. But he also is a heavy reader of a publication that the police were issued every month that's called the Police Gazette. Now, these days we'd have any number of digital and printed communications for police, and they'd be made aware of every criminal that could be in Melbourne planning something. There'd be, you're looking at emails, internal news on internet. There's a huge amount of information that police would have access to. But back then, once a month they'd get this publication, and it was a book, small book, but it was a book, and it had photos of criminals who were being released from prison with mugshots saying, watch out for these guys, they're about to be released. It had just list after list of, Mr. Joe Smith had stolen from him the lamps from the front of his horse and carriage. They look like this if you see them in a pawnbroker's shop. So it was a huge amount of information that was all about every crime that was reported, more or less. And the police were expected to read the thing cover to cover. Now, let's call it. I reckon most police would probably skim it. They'd particularly look for areas. So if you're working in the Fitzroy cop shop, you'd read it for the Collingwood, Fitzroy, North Melbourne, maybe Carlton, certainly. But Sickadyke, he managed to read it cover to cover, and it was quite apparent because he read a story in it that named a couple of young people. Now, it kind of relates to his gut instincts, and he has a gut instinct one day, and he's sitting at his desk, and he rounds up another copper who's at the police station with him, and he's got this kind of almost Sherlock Holmesian sixth sense going on. And so he rounds up a young policeman who's at the station, a fellow called Constable Rankin, and they jump in the squad car and they go for a random drive. Now, this in itself wasn't common. Only 20 years before that, police were almost exclusively bound to walking a beat. There was no just joyriding looking for criminals, and even then the beat was mapped out, and that was the only route they could take unless they saw a crime or heard a crime. So plainclothes constables really doesn't happen until the end of the 1800s, beginning of 1900s. And so he's doing some really cutting-edge policing by just saying, I've got a gut instinct. So they head out, and they go driving around Geelong. If you've never been to Geelong, there's a village cinema there that has always been a theatre. Still there, but it was a theatre back in the day, and has a beautiful big facade, that kind of Edwardian-era facade. They drove past it with it on their right, and they turn right at the end of the street, which goes up the hill towards the Catholic Cathedral. So they, as they're just kind of cruising, just looking at the lay of the land, they see something that makes him realize there was a reason why they left. So walking down the hill is four young people, and they're in their late teens, between 18 and 20 years old. And it instantly makes Sickadyke realize that he'd seen an exact description of them in the police gazette. He hadn't seen photos, but he knew what he was looking at. Now that's pretty impressive. If you've never seen a police gazette, head over to the internet and Google any number of places, you can see them. But they're brief. Like, it'll say something very simple, like, it's almost bullet point. It's like, Roy Malloy, comma, wanted for larceny, which was what they had described theft as, comma, stole £2.03 from the till of the Young and Jackson's Hotel, May 31st, comma, wearing blue sack suit. And that'll be about it. I mean, it's really vague. So he was able to link what he read in the police gazette to what he was looking at. There were a couple of things that were a little bit more unusual, but it's still impressive policing. So as he looks at the pavement, he sees four young people walking down the hill. It's a time of day when they should have been at work. It's a weekday. It's the middle of the morning. And that's the first thing that kind of springs to mind. Four young people should be at work in their late teens, early 20s. They're all carrying each one of those old school cardboard suitcases. Okay, so this is the kind of thing I wouldn't look twice at that. Just, have my own thoughts going on. But he looks at them as a policeman, and he sees something that shouldn't, it's just out of the ordinary. So the people he's looking at are wanted for a string of things. Their names are Leslie Ralph Francis Hoban. So Leslie Hoban, he's 18, he's a student. than his brother Bernard Doyle Hoban. There's a 20-year-old cook called Frank Goodway. He's got an alias, this bloke. He's Frank Lester. And then Patricia Goodway. Turns out that Patricia and Frank are married. So Frank is 24. Patricia is 18. The brothers are 18 and 20. So that's your group of four. And they're walking down the street. They're dressed quite nicely. But they're carrying suitcases. So Sikidike, he just has a suspicion. So he drives the car down the hill a bit. They're walking down the hill towards the sea. It's a fair hike. I mean, it'd be maybe almost a kilometre between where they are and the sea. Whether they're going to the sea, I don't know, but that's the direction they're going in. He drives down the hill, parks the car quietly, gets out. The fact that both these cops are in plain clothes is in their benefit right now, because they get to walk straight up to them, and these young people think they're just other pedestrians, and they stop them and they say, "Hey guys," flash a badge, "I'm Detective Sikidike. I want to ask you a couple of questions." So they kind of, it's not really described in any media at the time anything more about what that actual moment was like for anybody. Just says, you know, they got in the car. But when you understand a bit more about what was going on, their stomachs must have just sunk. The chances of him catching them, just walking down the street, is impressive. But they get in the back of the patrol car without much of a fight. He takes them to the police station. He sits them down in an office, asks them not to talk, separates them out into four separate offices, questioning rooms, and then he begins. Each of them has a suitcase, right? So he opens up each suitcase and he starts going through them. And there was the usual collection of, you know, clothing and personal effects. But scattered between the four suitcases were an ammonia pistol. Ammonia as in like the chemical. It's called an ammonia pistol. It's a handgun that's a bit smaller than a regular pistol, but you fill it like a water pistol with ammonia. Now, ammonia is I think you'd mainly only use it as a cleaning agent. And it's got that kind of smell. If you've ever smelt a cat box that needs changing desperately, or you've smelt English box hedge on a warm day, that's ammonia. Okay, so ammonia pistols were invented kind of 1900 to 1920 as a self-defense mechanism, kind of like a taser. A woman would load it up with ammonia, put it in her handbag, and if they were mugged or someone was chasing them, pull out the ammonia pistol and spray the guy. If it went in their eyes, it would really make life difficult. But ultimately, you're not going to kill someone. You're going to offend them but not assault them, right? So that's what an ammonia pistol is. It wasn't deadly, but it was going to make your chances of getting something you want a little bit better. So they've got the ammonia pistol in their suitcases. Then amongst them, there was it's kind of hard to describe. They call it a sandbag. Now, I had to research this a little bit, but it was... When I was younger, with my brothers, we'd take a pair of socks, we'd put one sock in the other sock and push it all the way down to the end of the toe, and then we had a sock with a weight in the end, and we'd swing it around our heads and try and whack each other with the hard end. And it gives you it's a good whack. A sandbag is much the same, and they would use a sock a lot of the time. They'd fill it with just a fistful of sand, and then tie a string to the sock with this weighted ball of sand at the end. You'd swing that and you'd hit someone in the head and it would knock them clean out, but because it has a softness to it, it wouldn't cut the skin. It was a nasty weapon. And you know those cartoons where you see the policeman with a kind of a leather truncheon and he belts someone on the back of the head and they're knocked out? That's kind of the same effect that this thing was going for. So look, you know, that was in there as well. Two of them had long sheathed knives in their bags. One of them had a glass cutter. and the other three had electric torches in their suitcases. Now, electric torches weren't common, just to be clear, in the 1920s. So these things all stand out, and they're incriminating by themselves. But the police could do them with possessing housebreaking equipment. That's a charge. So they're already in a bit of trouble. But it's when Sickerdyke finds a checkbook that he really knows. He knows he's found who he's looking for. So all the bits and pieces that they've got together, it's the checkbook that links them back to a whole bunch of things. Now, I guess the logistics of this policing are also worth mentioning. It's not then just a matter of him punching into the computer, Bank of New South Wales, which it was, that's who became the Commonwealth Bank, sorry, the Westpac Bank, the Bank of New South Wales in the long run, but there's a Bank of New South Wales checkbook. He wouldn't be able to just punch in the serial numbers into a computer and go, oh yeah, you've used this before. He had to, at best, use radio to find other people who had written down information about where these checks have been showing up. He could have written letters, I guess, or maybe at best send a letter on the train that might reach Melbourne by the afternoon. But he's looking for four young people who are using bogus checks. Now, false representation is the crime that they would have been committing if that was the case. So he starts doing the investigation, but it takes him some time. So he thinks to himself, you know what, I've got two options here. I can either start the letter writing process and try and, you know, detain these people and get the judge to let me keep them long enough to get letters back from Melbourne to say, yep, that's the serial numbers of the checks that have been showing up that were illegally written, or he could get them to confess. And that's the option that he took. So Sickerdyke gets them all in individual rooms, and he starts questioning them. And he begins with the brothers. Now the brothers, they're a cook and they're a student, so they're not haplessly out of work. It is a tough time to be alive. A few years later, in 1929, when the stock market crashes, it gets a whole lot worse. But you know, they're not wealthy kids. They're from the country, and they're pretty quick to start, confessing as much as they can. But it's only when Sickerdyke bails up the last of them, Frank Goodway. He says, look, you need to hear me, mate. You got a young bride in there. She's 18 years old. If you don't confess, I'm going to be putting Patricia at 18, just turned 18, in a women's prison. He explains what that means, and Frank does the right thing, and he confesses. So they all admitted to having used the checkbook, but they'd obtained it simply by going into a bank and saying, here's a little bit of money, I want to open an account, give us a checkbook. They knew full well that the checks were valueless because they had no money in the account. But once they realised how useful having a checkbook was, it made them decide to, in part, to spend their time focusing more on using the checkbook than housebreaking and mugging, which they'd kind of thought they might be doing. And it's hard to understand how four people, young people, probably just the glamour and the romance of, you know, playing gangsters, but they form this gang with a very deliberate intention to be a gang, to mug people, to rob houses. They made that decision. But then when they came up with a checkbook, it was just a license to print money. So their journey began in a place called Murchison, which is it's kind of northish. Then they went to Tatura and then Rushworth. They're all out of country towns to Melbourne. They'd been doing it for about 3 months, and they'd been on the road where they'd left home, and they were just making their way, stealing, robbing. They had managed to get £70, which was a lot of money, but they did that by cashing false checks. They separated with a small number of checks each when they got to Melbourne, and they went to various shops, and they had a task they were going to meet up later. They'd walk in and they'd say, look, I've got this check, it's for, let's say £15. Can I buy this thing worth £3, and would you give me change in cash for the difference? So that was how they were doing it. And look, they'd go to lolly shops, various other places and buy very small things. They came back themselves and they pulled everything they had together, and each of the boys cut out £20 each, and they gave Patricia £10. I dare say that's not because she didn't contribute. That would be straight up sexism right there. And look, we all know that women have been horrifically mistreated with that gender inequality for no good reason. And I mean, there you have a 50% stakeholder for probably doing equally the same amount of work. Once they were in Melbourne, they opened another account with the State Savings Bank, which became Commonwealth, in order to get a new chequebook. They went on another spree in Melbourne, and then they arrived in Geelong, and they were just kind of getting ready to work up their scam again when they got caught. After the confession, Goodway was able to tell Detective Sicker Dyke everything he needed to know. It was a pretty clean-cut case, because having given the confession, they pled guilty. Frank Goodway was given 2 years, while Hoban brothers were given a year each. This story is one of the shorter stories, and I'm kind of skimming through a few other details here in this presentation for the podcast. But the longer story with more detail and photos and mugshots are in the book that I'll be launching this December, which is called The Push Gangs of Melbourne. And some of the stories I've been able to put in there, I've enjoyed writing it, because I would never have guessed any of these things. But there's more to the outcome and the court case in the book, and I'd love you guys to check it out. In the meantime, I do have a piece on my professional author page, which is called Roy Molloy Author, and that's available on Facebook for you guys to jump over and check out. In the meantime, make sure you do take a look at the link in the description, which is the link to all my books, and they can be purchased by just Googling Roy Molloy, M-A-L-O-Y, and The Dawn of Crime. Thanks for listening.